Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's April 28th, 47 degrees in Old Town Park City under mostly sunny skies. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning. So temperatures for today are going to be actually really pleasant. We're seeing upper 50s of 58 is your expected high temperature with mostly sunny skies. A mainly clear night, so we're going to see upper 30s, 39 degrees as your expected overnight low. But by tomorrow, we're going to climb into the upper 60s. The two warmest days of the week will be Wednesday and then Thursday. Looks like a 69 on Wednesday and 67 on Thursday. But I am tracking a few showers likely to move in late Thursday into Friday, just scattered at best. But on Friday, we will see some convective activity. So I do think for the second half of Friday, temperatures are going to climb into the low 60s, but we'll see plenty of sunshine, which will trigger isolated thunderstorms for the afternoon and for the evening hours. Now, on Saturday, it's not going to be a completely dry day, so keep that in mind. That is going to be the wettest day of this week. Highs are going to dip into the upper 50s, 57 degrees, but we are going to see some showers and some isolated thunderstorms. So a little activity moving through. It'll be breezy by Sunday and Monday. We're kind of tracking another, little disturbance that could move through there. So for Sunday, it looks like we could see some more showers clearing, and then we could also see a little bit of a changeover as temperatures start to kind of decline a little bit. Unfortunately, we go back into that winter-like temperature. So we hit low 30s on Sunday night. We could see that changeover. And then on Monday, our high is going to be in the mid-40s only. So we are definitely seeing a major temperature drop from this week to the following or the top of the following week. So in the meantime, enjoy these really nice temperatures.
Okay, Erica, thank you.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher, taking a look at the agenda for tomorrow's county council meeting. Later on, architect and project manager for the Park City School District Master Plan, Scott Later, talking about how the master planning process is coming along. Then Swanner Nature Preserve visitor coordinator Hunter Klingensmith has details about a virtual screening of the film 2040. That'll be followed by a panel discussion. And stay tuned also coming up on This Green Earth right after the local news hour. We'll be rebroadcasting a couple of interviews as we are moving into our new studios. First up, a professor of entomology and author Doug Talamy. His book, Nature's Best Hope, Conversation in Your Backyard, sparked a national conversation about the link between healthy local ecosystems and human well-being. And then a conversation with author John Ross. His book, Promise of the Grand Canyon, is a thrilling account of John Wesley Powell's perilous journey to lead the first successful expedition down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon, which waged a bitterly contested campaign for sustainability in the West. Again, all of that coming up on today's edition of This Green Earth. News time now, 8:10. Good morning. Well, Park City Lodging has taken a big hit from the COVID-19 shutdown orders that took effect in mid-March. They refunded nearly $1 million to clients who either cut their ski trip short due to the early closing of the resorts or canceled future lodging reservations. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more on that.
Owner and president of Park City Lodging, Rhonda Sedaris, says they gave back 100% of deposits and fees, and they're continuing to take cancellations. Sedaris believes it was the right way to build trust with their clients. She says not all lodging companies refunded their clients. A lot of people had trip insurance, but a virus epidemic is not covered under the Act of God clause.
A lot of travelers purchased trip insurance, but unfortunately, trip insurance didn't kick in because of force majeure. And now people don't trust trip insurance. We didn't take any cancellation fees. We first asked if the client would be willing to move their reservation forward. And if we got pushback, then we just gave them back their money. And I tell you, it went a long way.
Sedaris says they've lost reservations from international and business travelers, a variety of groups, and the summer math camp that books the month of July. Most international visitors book in advance, and she says most of the European markets are saying they won't come to the U.S. this year. Sedaris says they have blocked out reservation calendars until June 1st.
The hospitality was the hardest hit sector in Summit County. We gave back $955,000. Which is a big hit. but we will not open up our calendars for short-term stays. If we do, it'll be more for staycations. You know, if you've got to work from home and you need to get away from your kids, come rent a condo from us.
Summit County public health officials announced the plans to gradually reopen some businesses next month. Sedaris met this week with the Summit County Stabilization Working Group to strategize ways to safely reopen the lodging business.
We can make them, my cleaning standards and my check-in standards will probably be more strict than the county's. We'll do remote check-in. We'll do advanced registration with DocuSign. We assign them a code. We won't go into the property while they're there unless it's an emergency. We won't clean the property for a minimum of 48 hours after departure. We'll open up the doors, windows, and turn on fans. It takes us about an hour and a half longer to clean now because of the disinfecting and sanitation that we do.
Sedaris says summer numbers are down, but she thinks visitors may decide to drive rather than fly. As of this report, the Triple Crown softball event has not been canceled. She thinks leisure travel will return sooner than business travel. Many second homeowners offered to donate their property for first responders, healthcare workers, and victims of domestic abuse. Healthcare and first responders have not needed additional housing, but the Peace House has had needs, and victims are staying in secured, donated housing locations. Sedaris hopes to see an increase in bookings this summer as people decide to pursue outdoor activities. The president of the Park City Lodging Association, Danny Williams, told KPCW in an email that there were three hotel properties that received cease and desist orders from the county earlier this month. Williams says they filed an appeal because they had essential services they were supplying. He wrote that one family had a house fire. There were grocery store employees in another hotel. He says government employees, traveling nurses, and truck drivers were housed in some of the hotels that had received the order. According to Williams, all three hotels were granted the exception and agreed to take no visitation guests. He says none of the hotels are actively marketing to visitors. He says check-in and cleaning protocols are in place with all three hotels. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
8:14 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Summit County Council will start its virtual meeting tomorrow at 2:45 with a work session. Summit County Manager Tom Fisher joins me now with a preview. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
First item up for discussion regards a proposed emergency-related 2020 work plan. So what happens here?
Well, you'll remember during the budget adoption time in December, we worked with the council to develop a work plan for the entire county staff that kind of lays out what projects we're going to work on, not only from the standpoint from strategic initiatives, but also other projects that support the county and its ongoing operations. Very ambitious plan based on that budget and that level of staffing. Of course, a lot has changed since then, and so we need to adjust that work plan for the rest of the year so that we're realistic about what it is we're going to accomplish.
All right. So the idea is the county will continue to provide some essential services, but just doing less of it?
Well, there's some things that we can't stop the things that are already under contract, and some of those are in the transportation realm. We're going to finish the Jeremy Ranch interchange this year. We're going to continue to projects that are bonded for with our transportation taxes. We're going to continue to move forward, things like that. But there's other things that we can adjust, things that haven't been put under contract yet, or things that we just won't get to based on our staffing level. And so those are the things that we have to look at and see, you know, do we push those into a further year? Does it get to be a less of a priority to accomplish that task? And then we'll recontract with the council to make sure that they understand and the public understands what it is we're going to accomplish this year on top of our essential services.
All right. In addition to finishing the Jeremy Roundabout, we'll also build the road link from Bittner to Silver Creek?
Well, we're in the phase right now where we're doing survey, getting ready to design, working with landowners on property acquisition. We're going to continue that this year.
Okay. What about improvements to the Camas Park and Ride? Those will also be delayed?
The Camas Park and Ride is one of the projects that I'm suggesting we will delay.
All right. Looking at some of the major priorities, the environment, sustainability, the plan is to still pursue net zero electricity?
Absolutely. I mean, that project is one that Lisa the Yoder has been working on very heavily with our attorney's office over the past 2 years, with our partners in Park City and other municipalities in the county that have signed on to look at those options. We're going to continue that. That's one of the hallmarks of our sustainability initiative right now. However, one of the projects that we are going to slow is doing a deeper dive into our fleet management right now for looking at energy savings. We haven't been able to get that implemented to this point. We did lose a staff member in our sustainability area, and we're under a hiring freeze, so we're going to have to slow that project.
All right, and then what about workforce housing? Does that employee housing at the Canyon still proceed?
Of course, that's not our project. That's a private project by the Canyons Village Master Association. They have pulled all their permits. We understand that they're moving forward, so we'd love to see them break ground this year.
Another priority is mental health. In the current climate, that priority could be more important than ever. Do we change that?
Not really seeing any changes there. That program is, because it's such a large community-wide program, we kind of coordinate that and help those communities, partners work together within the health department. We don't see any change in that. Of course, we're still going to be providing the Medicaid-supported services that we're under contract for with the University of Utah.
All right. And then the plan is also to continue working on the development codes. That seems like that might be a lesser priority, or do we expect some kind of slowdown perhaps in the planning and zoning department, and it would be something to keep people employed, giving them something to do like this?
We're not really seeing, we actually have lost one of our planners in the last couple of weeks who took a job with a different municipality, a step up for him. But our staffing is being adjusted just by itself and with the hiring freeze. However, we're not really seeing a slow in projects right now, a little bit of a slow in applications, but building permits and projects that are moving forward and still moving through the planning process this year, we're still seeing that. We're going to have our first planning commission with the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission tomorrow afternoon into the evening. I expect that we'll still work on the code, Pat Putt has told me that we're still going to pursue the things that were on our agenda and in the work plan this year.
All right. Looking at the personnel policies, there's a COVID leave policy and face covering policy for the Mountain Regional Water District. Are these any different than for county employees in general?
The leave policy is based on the new federal guidelines that were put out in regards to the current emergency. So they're exactly the same as the county's policies. And I haven't read their mask policy, but I'm sure it's very similar because they based it on ours.
Okay. And then there's a resolution extending the declaration of local emergency. It's not incremental. It extends the declaration and prohibits special event permits until September 1st?
Well, that's our look at it right now. Of course, we're developing the new health order, which is probably going to come out on Friday. But we do have to make the step of extending our current order just in case the governor does not move us to a different risk level and move us into the stabilization phase and we continue with our current orders. We're not anticipating that at this point. All of the things that we're reading and hearing lead us to believe that the May 1st timeframe will be that point at which the governor moves us to the orange or moderate risk level according to his plan.
So the counties, should they adopt that resolution? Does that extend countywide, or is it just within the unincorporated areas? I mean, does it?
It extends countywide.
All right. So it would have precedence over anything Park City or Camas or Woodland would want to do.
That's correct. From the health standpoint, it certainly does.
Okay. So, but that, are we saying we just don't know that that date is set in stone at this point?
Well, we what we're saying with this agenda item is we know that our current order runs out on May 1st. And so we're taking advantage of the council's business period at this point to extend that order in case it needs to stay in place. It is likely that a new order will be put in place on May 1st.
All right. Let's see, a discussion on making a contribution to the Central Wasatch Commission. What have we been giving? What, $50,000?
Well, we gave three contributions of $50,000. I don't believe that included the 2019 year. I think it was 2018, 17, and 16. We have not given a contribution since. So the Central Wasatch Commission has been talking with its member agencies about contributions over the past year, and now the chair of the commission is who is also on our council is coming to ask for a further contribution.
So again, $50,000. I mean, it's not a lot of money, but given the current situation, does staff have a recommendation on this?
Well, we did budget for a level of contribution in the 2020 budget. It actually comes from one of our sales tax sources. However, we did not. It was very clear with the council that they wanted to bring this back to a council meeting for a discussion before any contribution was made. So this is to allow that contribution to happen. I'm not sure at what level that contribution is going to be asked for at this point.
All right. And then also a second round of cuts to the existing fiscal year budget after making cuts of about $3 million. Can you summarize what we're cutting now to get to that $7.1 million?
Well, it really is a lot of the same things, but at a little deeper level and a little bit more granularity. We're under a hiring freeze, so we've got a much more solid number of what that's going to bring us as far as savings for the year. We have reduced out our employee merit program from April 1st through the end of the year. We've touched equipment costs and travel and training and supplies for county operations this year, as well as some areas around our fleet system in order to either slow equipment purchases or canceled some that have already had been made. Those are the types of things we've touched. You'll notice that the cut is actually a little bit bigger than what the council asked for. They were asking us to prepare an overall cut of about $5 million. We've gotten above that because there are some grant adjustments that had to be made. Different than what the original budget projected, especially in the mental health and substance abuse area. We're not going to receive those grants, so we're taking them out of the budget and the associated expenditures. It doesn't mean the services aren't going to happen. They're still going to happen in the community, but the state decided that those grants would go directly to the recipient as opposed to through the county.
Okay. And we talked about this a little bit earlier with regard to the extended health order, but there is also a discussion, given that the Summit County Board of Health met on Monday. Can you tell us what the board did, if anything?
I'm not aware of what the board did. They met last night. I have not gotten a report on what they worked on yesterday.
Okay. Hey, Tom, anything else you want to mention?
Well, I just want to, I think that we're getting a lot of anticipation towards the May 1st date. Certainly we're all probably our levels of tolerance around stay-at-home orders and being away from work and all those types of things are wearing thin. But and our data does support moving on to the stabilization phase, as is described in the governor's plan. But we've got to stay vigilant and know that it's not going to be back to business as usual right away. We've got counties around us that are still surging. And as we all open up our economies and our workforces, we're going to see a lot of travel between counties. Pay attention to what the next health orders talk about and what they promote, because that's how to keep our folks safe and make sure that we can continue to do business throughout the rest of the year.
So I'm already seeing restaurants advertising that they're opening May 1st. So they know something that the rest of us don't, or is it just because they're part of that committee?
I don't think they know anything necessarily that the rest of us don't. I anticipate that there are going to be places that lean forward and try and promote something that's coming, and that would be natural. We still need to wait for the health order to really understand what's going to come forward.
Okay, Tom, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher, you're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Coming up now on 8:30, good morning. Well, the Park City Board of Education received an update on its master planning efforts at its meeting last week. On the phone with me, I have an architect with the firm MHTN and also the project manager, Scott Later. Good morning to you, Scott.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for being with us. So there are three main initiatives with this master plan. It's to move the ninth grade back to Park City High School, to group grades 6 through 8 for middle school, and to have pre-K and after-school programs at all four of our elementary schools. So does that need to be done all at once, or can we phase in the high school first, which I think is probably a top priority?
Absolutely. And that's the feedback we've heard from the community as well, is that the key effort in this strategy is really looking at how those ninth graders can get absorbed back into the high school program. And so that could be, we could imagine a scenario where that would be the first phase of the development work that could happen for the district. And that through a kind of a sequential rollout of ideas and process and plans, you could look at it almost a 10 to 15 year plan of accomplishing the work of all of these projects that we're discussing currently with the district.
All right. Well, it looks like the preferred option for the high school expansion would keep the Eccles Center for the Performing Arts intact and then expand to the east, and that would require the demolition of McPolin Elementary School. So it sounds like those two projects would have to be done at the same time if that's the option they chose, no?
It is one possibility. We are exploring a number of different options for McPolin in particular, whether that's an addition or a future relocation of that building. One thing that we're very sensitive to right now is the kind of the shifting market that we have, and we want to make sure that the strategies that we're presenting back to the district really are looking at a financial responsibility. And so we could foresee that there's a scenario that, yes, there could be an expansion to that eastern edge, but it could be more tucked closer to the building to allow for McPolin to remain. So we're still in the early process of developing those schemes for the high school. One recent development that we're working through right now is how we can begin to absorb the learning center into the high school program. And so that would involve looking at adding a little bit more real estate and space, but we're exploring strategies that could make that happen as well.
All right, because I saw in your presentation there is a page on the Learning Center, so it sounds like for now the current building stays and eventually gets transitioned back to the high school?
Correct, yeah. That's one of the scenarios we're working through right now. As I'm sure you're aware, that Kearns Boulevard is pretty congested sometimes, and so we're looking at strategies that would help alleviate the congestion into that Kearns campus. And fortunately, the Learning Center, as we have the opportunity to absorb that into high school, would open up some space for traffic circulation and the ability to pull people off of Kearns Boulevard just a little bit better.
Right. So does that mean that the high school needs to get bigger? Or, I mean, we're only talking about maybe, what, 50, 60 kids?
Correct, yeah. I mean, within that program, we actually feel that the existing building could accommodate those spaces. You've probably seen on the presentation that we gave to the board most recently, there was discussions about absorbing and kind of bolstering the CTE programs. And so we're looking at strategies of how that could potentially work into the high school site as well.
Okay. And so when we talk about CTE, we're talking about kind of the PC CAPS program and things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was,
you guys have an awesome PC CAPS program, and I think they're doing some fantastic work there. It really is a model for other districts. And so we want to make sure that we're providing the facilities that would accommodate those that awesome program, but then start to look at the other avenues that would even bring in programs that are currently bused out to Heber, and adding those facilities on site so that really you have a complete holistic high school education right on that Park City site.
Yeah, so it sounds like more than just the moving the ninth grade back into the high school, and what does that mean in terms of more addition, square footage space?
Sure, I think that's a great question. The general approach at this point is to explore all of the options and present that information back to the district and the board, so that they can make an informed decision about what direction they want to proceed. I think, like we mentioned, the primary goal is to pull that ninth grade group back into the high school. And so really the first step in this process would be finding that square footage and the real estate for them. We're exploring strategies and options with the high school team and the administration to look at the utilization rate within the school and see if there's underutilized spaces that we could kind of recapture to limit or reduce the amount of new square footage that we would need to build. And from there, then we would lay out a phased strategy of potential additions or remodels that would accommodate things like the learning center, the CTE components, even accounting for future expansion and growth within the community and population.
All right. So once we get the ninth graders back at the high school, that means that the eighth graders would remain at Treasure until we could add on to Ecker Hill?
That's correct. And it could be a flip-flop scenario that the eighth graders move into Ecker first and vacate a little bit of space so that while the high school work is happening, Treasure Mountain could really be a key phasing piece of the puzzle so that we were not having to bring on portables or relocatables on site. None of those decisions have been made at this point. We're really outlining the strategies to do that. But I think you're in the right that the whole goal is to make sure that the 6th through 8th grade are accommodated at Ecker Hill and look at the strategy on how we could accomplish that.
All right. Do we kind of have a list of priorities, though? I mean, what takes precedent? Getting the pre-K programs and after-school programs at the elementary schools or making additions to Ecker? That's what you're in the middle of kind of doing, I guess, huh?
Yep, absolutely. I think there was some fantastic work that was accomplished by the previous team to develop the educational master plan and facility assessment. And our goal as MHT and architects is to bridge that gap now between that work and eventual projects down the road. And so we're looking at those strategies. To date, although we've established kind of a list of priorities, we've not necessarily ranked those 1 through 10. And we really leave that at the discretion of the board to once they have that information, say, okay, let's kind of proceed in this direction, and they'll ask us additional questions, and we can follow up with more details based on their priority list.
All right. On one of the drawings, it looks like there is a pool expansion at Ecker Hill. Is this part of the master planning, or was this something that was contemplated well before this?
From what we understand, that was part of the strategy with the Basement Rec group, that in the future, there could be a potential expansion of that facility. And so I think with any of these strategies, the worst thing that we could do is put something in the wrong place. And in 10, 15 years, people are having to, you know, rethink how they're working around that new piece. And so we're cognizant that that is a possibility, not an eventuality, and that we want to make sure that any kind of reconfiguration of the building or parking lots for Ecker Hills would accommodate that future pool expansion.
All right. And I also got a kind of kick out of how we have call our new spaces. It's the cafetorium. How does that differ from a cafeteria?
So that's kind of the swing space. You mash all these ideas up and spit out new words. So a cafetorium really is a multi-use space that could be used temporarily or during the day as a cafeteria space. Mostly during the day, it could be a gymnasium area. After school, it could be a place for community events. And so it becomes kind of a multi-swing space within the neighborhood. We really see elementary schools as the heart of a community. And by allowing places to congregate and visit and socialize, it really becomes a neighborhood center for the building.
Yeah. And then also another gone are the classrooms, what we are now calling them learning studios. Again, how would that differ from what we see in today's classroom?
I think what's interesting about current educational trends right now, and I think PC or the Park City School District is really leading the charge on this, is the notion that there's, we call it a sage on the stage. Somebody's going to have all the information. They're going to present that to a student, and they're going to regurgitate that back in some sort of test form. And what we're seeing now is that people want the collaborative environments that really open up to different modes of learning, responding and being inclusive to all levels of academics. And so the idea of a learning studio is that this is a space, a flexible space, that could accommodate any of those learning activities. And that in the future, when learning shifts, the building doesn't necessarily need to be reconfigured or changed. That learning studio has the ability to adapt, whether that be with furniture or writable surfaces or finishes and textures, so that, again, we're not locking ourselves into, a 2020 model. We're kind of looking at a building in a larger stretch of what it could be down the future as well.
All right. And then for the $64 million question, how do we, or when will we know what all of this is going to cost?
So we are currently evaluating that right now and working with our cost estimating teams to establish those numbers. Our process is to take all of this information, kind of wrap our heads around it, and present that cost information back to the board. We're hoping that comes by the May board meeting. But we know that there's also a June board meeting that we could follow up with for future details. But it's something that we're anxiously working on and looking in addition to what are those key phasing strategies and steps that the district could possibly take and allocating kind of cost and data to that so that really at the end of the day, the district has all of the information to make that informed decision about how they would move forward.
Yeah, and that your firm was hired as the bond architect, so that what you're kind of proposing is that what it would take to actually bond, if we were to go out and bond, are we still talking about doing that for the November election, or that's up to the board?
I think that's a decision that the board would need to make, and obviously the current climate has changed some of that landscape, and so as we present information back to them, we're making sure that they have the full picture of possibilities, potentially even exploring outside funding sources that could look at a way of getting the ball moving on this first phase of work, but not necessarily locking you into a formal bond campaign. But it is a topic of discussion that we're still evaluating with the board and the administration team.
Yeah. And we've called this master planning effort all along the future of learning. Given how we have learned a lot with the schools closed these past 7 weeks, does that change what the future of learning should look like?
I think it's a really interesting question. It's something that as a firm we're constantly talking about right now. There always have been kind of blended models of learning in place within the state. I think we're seeing kind of an acceleration of those models right now. On a positive note, I think it shows that there's a potential to learn outside the classroom, to learn in environments other than kind of a formal school. I think additionally, though, it's shown, I can relate it to my own life. I really appreciate teachers right now. Probably more so than I ever have. And so I think you're seeing a group in the state that really, really wants to foster education in a formal setting and support the teachers where they can. And so I think it could be in the future a mixture of both, that some of the learning happens outside the classroom, and some of it, the social interaction that's very important, is happening within the school itself. And I think as we move forward, it's a piece of the puzzle that we're starting to evaluate as we look at overall utilization rates, that could be a key component to not necessarily add square footage to the building down the road, but as you shift to that blended model, the capacity of each school could increase without new building space. So I think it's a fascinating question that we're just kind of starting to wrap our heads around right now.
Yeah, sounds like it. All right, Scott, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, we appreciate the opportunity to get information out. It's definitely a different world, and we look forward to the chance of continuing our communication with the community and making sure that they're informed on the process. I think the district is really looking forward. We work across the state with a number of districts, and I think Park City is really leading the charge in its efforts to be forward-thinking and proactive about education and making sure that the buildings support that down the road.
All right. Scott Lader is the architect and project manager for the Park City School District's master plan. Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Great to be with you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:44. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, the Swanner Eco Center and Park City Film Series are partnering on a virtual screening of the film 2040. On the phone to tell us more, I have Hunter Klingensmith. She is the visitor coordinator at the Swanner Nature Preserve. Good morning to you, Hunter.
Hi, good morning, Leslie.
So when and where will this be shown or screened?
So it's actually a virtual screening. So you can go online and register at the Park City Film Series website. And then you have access to the film for 2 days, so April 30th and May 1st. So you can watch it anytime within that period.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the film?
Yeah, of course. So the film is by director Damon Gameau, who is award-winning and has quite a few other great films. And so it's all about what the future could look like in 2040 if we embrace the solutions that are already available to us in this current day and age. And it's all about solving current environmental issues that we have. And it's really great because he structures it as a visual letter to his four-year-old daughter when she's older. And so it has a really like fun, lighthearted feel and gives you really realistic solutions to a lot of the problems that we're facing. So I love that it has a positive outlook. It's not one of those downer environmental films for sure.
All right. So there's also a plan to have a post-film panel. So if people have the opportunity to watch this whenever they want, when does that actually happen?
So that will take place virtually as well. We'll do it as a webinar. And it happens on May 1st at 6:30 p.m. So anyone who registers for the film will also get the access link to access the webinar. And then they'll be able to ask questions of our panelists. So we have Christine McKell, who is the founder and principal at Enyo Renewable Energy, Dr. Tim LaSalle, who's the co-founder of the Center for Regenerative Agriculture and Resilient Systems at California State University. And then we also have Luke Carton, who's the Environmental Sustainability Manager for Park City. And so they'll all be there to sort of answer questions. We picked three people that focus on some of the main topics in the film.
Oh, okay. And again, there is an opportunity once people log on to have some kind of back and forth interaction.
Yes, definitely. So it'll be what will happen is I'll be moderating the panel, and what I'll do is I can bring the questions to the panel. So people will enter them in the chat or the Q&A section, and then we will bring those questions to the panel for them to answer.
All right. So there's a cost then to register?
Yeah, it's a free film. There is a suggested $5 donation per person to participate, but you can register for free if that's not an option for you.
Okay. And again, people can do that by going parkcityfilm.org?
Yep, or swannerecocenter.org and go to our calendar page. You can access the registration link from both.
Okay. Anything else you want to tell us about it?
I think that's it. It's a really great film. I watched it yesterday and I loved how upbeat it was. So it's definitely worth watching. It gives you lots of hope.
Okay. Hey, Hunter, thanks for your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you, Leslie. Have a great day.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. We've got 49 degrees here in Old Town Park City, looking for mostly sunny skies with a high of 62. Summit County officials are crafting a new public health order to be unveiled by the end of the week that will aim to gradually and carefully reopen activity in the county that after the COVID-19 lockdown. Members of the County Health Board meeting last night heard that the new directive will lift the stay-at-home order, but as KPCW's Rick Bruff reports, they are still advising the public to follow other restrictions like social distancing.
The new order would mean that the county moves from the red phase of its COVID-19 response, that is, urgent action, to the orange phase of stabilization. County Environmental Director Phil Bondurant said they want to dip their toe, as he put it, in terms of reopening business and activities. They will measure the medical data, and by May 15th, they will decide whether to continue further with stabilization or reverse course. Representatives for designated sectors of the local economy were scheduled to submit proposals by Monday. On Tuesday, they will be submitted to Deputy County Attorney Dave Thomas to be incorporated into the draft of a new health order. The order will be submitted to County Council on Wednesday for a discussion. On Thursday, the Council will review the order with local mayors. If approved, the order would take effect on Friday. County Council Member Kim Carson said it would likely take effect at the stroke of midnight on May 2nd. The details haven't been finalized yet, but Health Director Rich Bullough said it is following the directives of Governor Gary Herbert's program, Utah Leads Together 2.0.
If you look at 2.0 and you look at the currently, we're in red, the urgent phase. If you look at orange, there are some specific guidelines on gathering size, still recommendations on social distancing, recommendations on masks. All of those things we've been talking about that are in place will remain in place. What is being lifted is the stay-at-home order, which does ease restrictions on inter-county travel, those sorts of things.
On some specific questions, Bullough said state parks in the county will likely be open under the order. He said libraries will not be because sanitizing books is a difficult process. He said that the community and local business stepped up and helped to flatten the growth of COVID-19 cases. He said he could count on one hand the number of businesses that resisted the lockdown ordered in March by the health department.
Violations that we've seen with our existing order among businesses, most of those have been reported by other businesses. They know there's a lot at stake for them, and so they're watching each other. And it's important for the community to know that they need to be watching businesses as well. And we're going to ramp up. We've got a complaint line, and we also still have the hotline. We're going to be ramping up those services so that we can be on top of complaints as they come in.
If the reopening leads to an increase in coronavirus cases, the county could rebound from orange back to red. Bullough admitted that, in fact, his department and staff would be strained if they went through too many back-and-forth cycles.
Just to be really honest, we don't have the bandwidth and capacity to go through multiple cycles. And so it is important that we do this right. This is exhausting. And if we ease and then have to put in new restrictions and then do a bunch of contact tracing and case investigation, and then we ease again, we're going to see multiple cycles of this regardless because of the seasonal variation and the expected surge in the winter and fall and winter. So we need to prepare for that, and we can't destroy ourselves in the process of making mistakes right now.
Kim Carson said that even if the county goes to orange status, it still won't be business as usual for residents.
It means Yep. You should be wearing a mask when you're out in public. You should be doing your hand washings constantly. Keep hand sanitizer with you. Really only go out. I mean, I hope that our restaurants and stores do get some business, but be practical and don't go out on a shopping spree just because you can, and watch group gatherings.
Summit County Council Member Kim Carson. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, Utah's COVID-19 task force has marked this Friday, May 1st, as a date for a gradual reopening of the state. KPCW's David Boyle reports Wasatch County is busy preparing local businesses for when the county decides to open.
Wasatch County Manager Mike Davis says while essential businesses such as grocery stores have remained open, if the county is to begin opening other businesses, there will be provisions. Davis explains Health Department Director Randall Probst has been working with businesses, creating a plan for eventual reopening of services.
They have to have a plan in place for masks, gloves, social distancing, and so forth. And he's been working with those plans. So if that happens, it will likely happen on the 1st.
Businesses who have a plan in place can apply to the county for needed supplies. The county has ordered hand sanitizer, disinfectants, and 50,000 surgical masks to make available to businesses. Davis says the county will spend $60,000 this week on supplies and will continue to order them as needed. The county is ordering supplies in part because of established connections and also because they can order in mass volume.
We're using every avenue we can to find these types of supplies, and when they're in short supply, I think it's a little bit who you know.
Davis says that they'll ask businesses who use the supplies to pay the county back at cost, although a few businesses might not be able to pay for the supplies up front.
But some of these businesses without income have just drained their savings accounts, and so hopefully we can help them get back on their feet.
Businesses with questions about necessary supplies and general inquiries about economic response to COVID-19 in the Heber Valley can reach out to the Heber Valley Chamber of Commerce. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
The massive Dakota Pacific mixed-use development will be back before the Snidaville Basin Planning Commission tonight when the commission will consider a revised plan that fits within the approved density. The Planning Commission is meeting only in a work session. The 50 acres at Kimball Junction was originally approved as the Park City Tech Center with nearly 1.3 million square feet for a research park and about 200,000 square feet of residential housing. The new property owner, Dakota Pacific Real Estate, brought forth a new plan last year that added at about a half million square feet to that density, doing away with the tech center idea. Now the Planning Commission will consider a revised plan to avoid Section 2.3 of the Snyderville Development Code from kicking in. This section requires that the county not approve any new entitlements unless they offer a significant countervailing public interest. Summit County Planner Kirsten Whetstone says the revised plan reduces the total square footage to within just 6,000 square feet of the original tech park approval.
So this new plan reduces the overall square footage of residential, office, retail, and hotel components so that now they're proposing 1.289 million square feet. That excludes the deed-restricted housing. Now, their entitlement is 1.295 million square feet, which also excluded the deed-restricted housing, which got built as the Liberty Peak Apartments. And so they're now have an overall reduction in what we call floor area, or the million square feet, the 1.289.
The applicant is also proposing 35 fewer residential units.
Now they're proposing 1,100, of which 306 are deed restricted and 794 fall into the market range. All but 80 of those are rental units, although there are 714 market rental units, 306 deed restricted rental units, and then 80 market rate condominium ownership condominiums. And we still don't know what the restrictions will be on those, whether they'll be nightly rental or they're allowed to be, we haven't really gotten to that point.
So the question for the Planning Commission is now a change of use application instead of a research office park. Does the county want a mixed-use area with a 122,000-square-foot hotel, 235,000 square feet of office space, in addition to the already approved 1,100 residential units? Gone is the proposed 50,000-square-foot civic center. Whetstone says that was taken out of the plan because the applicant was hoping to do a land swap with the county for the parcel where the Richland Services Building and the Transit Center are located. But she says that swap is on hold until they have some direction from the county council. She believes the land swap, though, is still part of the long-term plan.
Because those discussions are likely to take some time in terms of working out all the details, we really haven't had a chance to get to the county council to see whether that would be the direction they would even want to go. So what they did was they left those two parcels, which are at the far northeast corner of this property, they left those out, that they don't control them anyway. They're, you know, the county owns them. And what they did was they went back to sort of a hybrid of the old plan, which was to show offices.
The proposed underground transit center with structured parking has gone also away for now and has been changed to surface parking. Again, Whetstone says that a new underground transit center would require a number of other improvements to happen. So for now, the applicant just wants to build in some flexibility. A webpage has been dedicated to this application. You can find that as well as a link to join the Zoom meeting for tonight within this story online at kpcw.org. The meeting will open for regular business only to elect a new chair and vice chair. KPCW News Time now, 8:59.
Morning Edition and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is brought to you in part by Intermountain Park City Hospital, Intermountain Heber City Hospital, and the Red Ledges Community.
Well, in an effort to honor the loyalty of its pass holders and perhaps stave off a class action lawsuit filed against them, Vail Resorts announced that it will provide last season's pass holder credits of at least 20% and up to 80% if they weren't able to use their pass at all. That will be applied to the purchase of an Epic Pass for next season. Additionally, the company will extend the time pass holders can purchase next year's pass at the best price. Vail Resorts Chief Marketing Officer Christian Lenge says that they hope the plan will demonstrate their commitment to pass holders to honor their loyalty. In a prepared statement, she wrote, quote, "Our pass holders are our most loyal guests, and we have spent weeks reading their emails and concerns on social media to fully understand their concerns so that we could respond thoughtfully and carefully. What became clear," she said, "is that to address last season, a one-size-fits-all approach won't work. Based on the resort's closures in mid-March, which impacts about 20% of the core season, higher credits will be offered to pass holders who use their pass less than 5 days. A maximum credit of 80% will be offered if the last year's pass wasn't used at all. For those who have remaining days on their Epic Day Pass for last season, the company will provide a credit for each unused day." Lynch says pass holders will be mailed individually in the coming weeks with their specific credit information and a promotion code, which they can use online starting May 13th. The credit is valid through Labor Day, September 7th. Additionally, the company is offering free Epic coverage for the upcoming season, which will provide cash refunds to pass holders for certain resort closures, including events like COVID-19, as well as refunds for job loss, illness, and other eligible personal events. You can find a link to the plan as part of this online story at kpcw.org.